Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present to you once again Wesley J. Smith, the author of the book Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published in hardcover by Times Books, copyright 1997. And let me add that Wesley Smith is the co-author with Ralph Nader of four titles. Am I right, Wesley?
That's right, four of them.
I also want to say to the audience, at the risk of seeming something less than objective, that this book gets my five-star rating. It gets the Dave Emery five-star rating. And, Wesley, I want to congratulate you on writing what I think is one of the most important books that I have ever read. And I think if society manages to avoid this slippery slope, an awful lot of people and a lot of institutions are going to owe you a debt of gratitude greater than they are ever likely to be able to repay.
Well, I appreciate that very much. You know, I think assisted suicide and what I call related issues that deal with issues such as refusing desired medical treatment from people because they're disabled or dying, healthcare rationing, some of the changes that are on the horizon in organ procurement, changing the definition of death, and other utilitarian concepts, I think are the most important issues we face as we create the ethic that will guide and govern the 21st century. So what we're dealing with here is incredibly vital. And what I find most disturbing is that most people are tuned out and not paying any attention, and that is allowing a very few number of people in the elites and among the academics who don't, subscribe to values that most Americans do to basically guide and mold where we're heading, and I find that very disturbing. That's why my next book is on bioethics, and I'm trying to warn people that there are some very difficult times coming, and we need to pay attention.
I think that members of the listening audience should be advised, those of you, they're new listeners, but older listeners, ones who have been with me for a long portion of the 20 years I've been on the air, of all the titles that I've dealt with, of all the issues I've dealt with, I think this is the issue that is going to prove deadly to the members of the individual audience, probably more so than any other I've ever covered. This is going to be how the macro political forces that I've been analyzing for these two decades on the air are going to come home and walk right in the listeners' front doors, sit down, and devastate their existences, and probably those of their loved ones as well. And again, I think listeners could do no better than to get this book and read it. And we should probably stress, Wesley, that I get no money from Times Books or from you for doing this.
Well, I appreciate the plug, and it's not like I'm getting rich off it either.
Right. No, I don't imagine you're going to be getting any medals for doing what you've done. You mentioned the concept of utilitarianism, Wesley. Maybe we should start this interview. And by the way, I also want to mention there is a previous interview with Wesley Smith that's available from Spitfire, the tape duplication service that stocks the various tapes that I've done. The concept of utilitarianism and futilitarianism lies at the very core of your analysis. If you could explain that to us.
Sure. I'm not a philosophy academic or anything, but utilitarianism is basically, and I'll just speak about it generally, is basically an idea that the purpose of society is to maximize happiness and reduce suffering. That sounds good, but when you take a look at what it means in practice, is you're really instituting a form of social Darwinism and the potential destruction of the weak in favor of the strong. I in a bit of a polemic way, put it like this. Utilitarianism, as being advocated by bioethicists, is if it feels good, do it. If it feels bad, kill it. That is a real problem we are facing. We are facing people who are saying that people with quadriplegia, for example, may not be worth the money that it takes to care for them properly. Therefore, we should not take care of them properly because we have to maximize societal happiness, and if some individuals fall by the wayside, well, that's just too bad. Futilitarianism is a word that I believe I coined. I may not have, but I think I did. And that deals with a new concept in medical bioethics called futile care theory, F-U-T-I-L-E. And what that's about is doctors, health insurance executives, bioethicists saying that doctors have the right to refuse service to people they don't want to treat based on the doctor's perception of the patient's quality of life. Thus, if a patient wants to, for example, have a feeding tube pulled from a family member wants to have a feeding tube pulled from somebody who's severely cognitively disabled, we will say, yes, of course, that must happen because autonomy is sacrosanct. However, if that same person says, no, I want the feeding tube for my severely cognitively disabled relative, futile care theory says, no, we can't do that because it doesn't benefit the patient, or in an alternative theory, it takes up too many resources and distributive justice requires that we refuse that. Therefore, what we're really talking about is a belief system that says when life reaches a certain point of disability or illness, the answer isn't proper care, the answer is death. If autonomy gets us there, well, that's best because then we don't have to worry about going through bioethics committees and so forth. But if autonomy doesn't get us there, then we'll impose it, and that's what feudal care theory is all about.
You mentioned something that we touched on ever so briefly in our last interview, the CCMD, which is an institution that's redefining medical care and the physician's responsibility in a fashion not altogether unlike the way it was redefined in Germany in the lead-up to the Nazi T4 program.
Right. Well, the CCMD is the Colorado Collective for Medical Decisions, and in Forced Exit, I take about 8 pages for feudal care theory, since most of Forced Exit deals with assisted suicide and euthanasia. However, feudal care theory, even since 1997, has been growing geometrically. And as I've been doing research for this new book on bioethics, and as people out there have been leaking policies to me out of hospitals and so forth, I find that it is coming down the track like a freight train out of control. Feudal care theory is already being imposed in hospitals across this country. There's a hospital in San Jose called the Alexian Brothers, which has what they call a non-beneficial care policy or an inappropriate care policy. Those are other terms used for feudal care, in which they basically create a set of conditions which they say treatment for is inappropriate other than comfort care. And any doctor who wishes to treat these conditions has to justify it in writing, and even staff members who see doctors providing what the Alexian Brothers policy calls inappropriate care are urged to report the doctor to the head of medicine. It's very disturbing. And then you read in the medical literature in Detroit, in Houston, and other places, there are hospitals forming these policies and agreeing to honor each other's policies. So a patient caught in a feudal care situation will have no place to turn to. What will happen is a doctor will say to a patient or a patient's family, I will not treat this any further. It is feudal. If the patient disagrees, it goes to a bioethics committee in the hospital made up of anonymous people who are not answerable to anybody, who do not issue written reports and have no appeal process often. And if the bioethics committee, and sometimes the family or patient isn't even able to appear in front of the bioethics committee, and if they decide that the condition is futile or inappropriate, then the patient will have it refused unilaterally or is asked to find another hospital. But often no other hospital will take the patient. So there you are, and that's beginning to lead to some lawsuits, and it's very disturbing. You've had parents lose the right to make medical decisions for their children because they refuse to accede to doctors' demands that they turn their children off life support, just as an example.
You talked about, we have spoken about the key German text Binding and Höcke, which in many ways paved the way from a philosophical and ethical standpoint for the German euthanasia program, which peaked under the Third Reich. And I want to remind listeners that the Third Reich's racial laws were heavily influenced by American eugenics thinking and legislation. In discussing the slippery slope from assisted suicide to legalized murder, you compare some legal decisions by Judge Stephen Reinhardt with key aspects of the Binding and Höcke text. I wonder if you develop that further for us.
Sure. Binding and Höcke were two German academics in 1920 who wrote a book called Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life. Binding was a lawyer and Höcke was a physician. And the thesis of Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life was that there are three categories of people who it is not only acceptable to kill, but ethical to kill. And that was people who are terminally or mortally ill, people who are permanently unconscious, and what they called the idiots, i.e. disabled people, whether or not physical or mental. They coined, as far as I can tell, the term right to die back in 1920. They said, in essence, this is not killing, this is the right to die. Stephen Reinhardt, now the Binding and Höcke book, Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life, took off like gangbusters in Germany in the 1920s. This is before Hitler, was in power.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1927, as I recall, there was a poll taken of parents of disabled children, and more than 70% of the parents in this poll in Germany said that it should be acceptable for doctors to kill their children if it would be done painlessly. Now, if the parents were saying that, imagine what the general population thought. So by the time Hitler got into power in the 1930s, Germany was very well prepared to accept euthanasia, and to accept euthanasia of disabled people as well as terminally ill people. And it was based primarily on this Binding and Hoke book and the subsequent discussions and arguments that came as a result of it.
By the way, Hitler was heavily influenced by that text.
Oh, yes. In fact, he allowed Binding died shortly after the book was published, but he allowed Hoke to use his name in advertising some of his other works because Hitler was so impressed. And Hitler thought this fit right into Hitler's position that life is a struggle. You know, he had a very social Darwinistic view that life is a struggle, and each country is in competition, and in order for the struggle to prevail, we have to get rid of our weak links, which is one of Hitler's ideas that he accepted. He certainly didn't create the idea. That led in 1939 to the first euthanasia of a disabled infant, and this was not done in a sense of involuntarily or, you know, stormtroopers coming to somebody's house and grabbing their child out of the crib and killing it. What happened was a father of a baby, an infant, named Baby Nauer, K-N-A-U-E-R, the baby was born with defective limbs and other physical problems, birth defects, and the parents of this child were so ashamed to have created this useless eater, as the term was used in Germany in those days, this life unworthy of life, that they wrote to Chancellor Hitler, and they said to Chancellor Hitler that they wanted permission to have their baby put down, to be killed. And Hitler had been seriously considering these issues and receiving a lot of mail in that regard. And so he decided the time was ripe. It was end of 1938, early 1939. And so he sent his personal physician, one of his doctors, Dr. Brandt, to investigate with instructions that indeed, if the child is as advertised, then the doctors of the child should be assured that they could kill the child and there would be no legal ramifications. That is exactly what occurred, and the baby was killed. Now, let me fast forward for a second. Now, that sounds horrible and disgusting, and it is. It is the legalized murder of an infant because the infant is disabled. And we say, well, that's Adolf Hitler permitting it, that's the atmosphere of the Third Reich. Some of your listeners may have heard of a current philosopher named Peter Singer. Peter Singer is an Australian. He created the modern radical animal rights movement with a book called Animal Liberation. And he is also the major proponent of legalized and ethical infanticide in the world, perhaps. He has written that parents should, if they have a child born that is born with a birth defect, even though he doesn't even limit it to birth defects, but let's just say a child is born with a disability, if that is going to cause more unhappiness for the family to keep the child than to kill the child, utilitarianism, that the parents should be able to kill the child and start again, in his terms. In fact, he posits that parents should have 28 days to decide whether to keep or kill their children. Now, that is exactly the scenario I just described, is it not, with Baby Nauer back in 1939 and the parents asking Hitler for permission to kill their child because the child was born with disabilities. Peter Singer, when he goes to Germany or he goes to Switzerland or Austria, cannot speak because there are so many demonstrations in the street based on what the demonstrators call, and these are left-wing demonstrators, not right-wing demonstrators, they call it Nazism and Nazi thinking. And I'm afraid that the demonstrators are right. Now, Singer, that was a Freudian slip. Singer.
Dermeister Singer.
Yeah, Singer gets very upset at the demonstrators because he's Jewish, and he said that he lost family members in the Holocaust, and how dare they accuse him of Nazi thinking. But what he is proposing is exactly identical to what occurred back in 1939. So your listeners may be saying, well, so what, that's just one man's opinion. Well, Peter Singer is one of the most respected bioethicists and philosophers in the world. He wrote the ethics section for the Encyclopedia Britannica. He travels the world speaking and writing, and he has just been given a very prestigious tenured professorship at Princeton University.
Which, of course, is an Ivy League school and one of our most elite institutions.
That's right. So to say that all of this discussion of you know, life unworthy of life is irrelevant because it's Hitler. The main proponent of that very philosophy today, which comes right out of Permission to Destroy, Life Unworthy of Life, has just been given a prestigious appointment to Princeton, will be teaching our future doctors, teaching our future healthcare executives, and spreading his bile from a position of great prestige. The imprimatur of Princeton has gone to infanticide based on disabilities. Now, if Princeton appointed a pro-life person to a bioethics chair, there would be howls of protest from the academy. If Princeton put in David Duke into that chair because he's a racist, there would be demonstrations in the street for appointing a racist to the university. But a man who specifically advocates killing disabled infants because they are disabled is allowed to go to that institution with very little protest except from people like me who write a couple of articles.
Also, I want to remind listeners or inform listeners that in one passage in Forced Exit, you compare key passages of the Binding Hulk text, again, which profoundly influenced Hitler and the Third Reich, and you compare those with some legal rulings by Judge Stephen Reinhardt, which...
your question, and I got off on a tangent. The Stephen Reinhardt decision was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in the Compassion in Dying versus Washington, which was reversed, thank goodness, by the United States Supreme Court last year. Reinhardt, who is the Chief Justice of the Ninth Circuit, basically wrote that there was a constitutional right to assisted suicide and euthanasia, using the very same words, almost identical, or clauses or phrases, certainly thoughts, that Binding and Hoke did in Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life. Which in Forced Exit, I took what Binding and Hoke said and I juxtaposed it next to what Reinhardt said, and the similarity of thinking and expression and thought and ideas is striking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is no longer the law because the United States Supreme Court reversed it. But that a Chief Justice of the Ninth Circuit on an 8-3 vote for an en banc hearing could basically parrot that kind of thinking shows you how close it is to ethical and moral acceptance in this country.
One of the things that you speak about in Forced Exit is, of course, the slippery slope. It's in the subtitle. And you talk about Oregon's Proposition 116. Proposition 16, excuse me. And how that was in many ways exemplary of the type of breakthrough legislation that the death lobby, as you put it, has been seeking, and the insidious and Orwellian language in which the concepts are couched. I wonder if you would develop that further for us.
Sure. Proposition 16, or Measure 16, as it was called in Oregon, passed by 51-49% back in 1994 and was reiterated by Oregon voters 60-40% in 1996, I believe, or it might have been 1997, probably 1997. And, excuse me, I apologize, I have a cold here. It is the first legalization of assisted suicide in the world, other than a very brief period in Australia's North Territory that was overturned by the federal parliament. It permits people diagnosed with a terminal condition who are believed to have 6 months to live to receive a lethal prescription. Now, when you hear people talk about this, they will say it is as a last resort only when nothing else can be done to alleviate pain and suffering. But there actually, in the so-called guidelines, is no requirement that there be any actual pain and suffering. The only requirement is that there be a diagnosis. It is done in absolute secret. The only time people know anything about it is if a doctor fills out forms. And if the doctor has violated the guidelines, he's not going to admit it on the forms. And the only people who know what's going on now in this assisted suicide regime that's going on in Oregon are the death ideologues in Compassion and Dying, a suicide group, and the Hemlock Society, another suicide group. They're the ones who announce the deaths. Everything from the state is kept secret, except they will release statistical information without any kind of ability to engage in any oversight at all, even to check death certificates to see if the person was really sick, because it's all couched in absolute secrecy. Because to allow light into this horrible regime would be to cast aspersion upon it. So the only thing we hear is what the death ideologues want us to hear. But even what they tell us, we can see how horrible this is. The first death was announced not by the people of Oregon or even the family. It was announced by Barbara Coombs Lee, who's the head of Compassion and Dying, and a woman with cancer committed assisted suicide legally in Oregon. And the woman left an audio tape. You know, this is Kevorkian stuff, where after the fact we're going to be given this audio or visual demonstration of why it was so essential for the killing to take place. And in the audio tape, the woman said she was killing herself not because she was in pain, but because she couldn't stand the stress. Now, you know, when people get a terminal diagnosis, it's a very difficult time. But Kubler-Ross talks about, you know, like you do go through anger, depression, and acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in this assisted suicide regime is when you get people, when they're in the anger or the depression time, when they're, you know, having to come to grips and try to adjust with the changed world, and they want to die, well, of course, we'll kill them. But what's very striking about this is that the woman's own doctor who knew her condition, refused to participate. Another doctor diagnosed her as clinically depressed. So what did she do? She went to Compassion and Dying, who sent her to a rubber stamp doctor, who said she's not depressed, she's frustrated, and she was dead within 2 weeks. This is assisted suicide. It is not compassion. It is not based on long-term relationships and meaningful interaction as to values and options and alternatives. It is based on ideology in which these rubber stamp ideologues basically are willing to help kill people who are depressed or who are scared and have no meaningful relationship with them and don't even engage in suicide prevention, which can keep people from doing it, and don't even consider the fact that when people go through their adjustment, they might change their minds. It is the most astonishing abandonment, masking as compassion, but we as the American people don't go through that kind of thought process. We just see, oh, they want to die, oh, they've got cancer, I'd want the right, it should be done. And that is just an astonishing, I think, abdication of our human responsibilities to each other.
Now, certainly when someone receives a terminal diagnosis, and by the way, we should point out those are not always accurate by any means.
You know, my first hospice patient, I'm a hospice volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I met with Ernie, he was crying. He cried in my arms, saying, I want to die. I want to die. I'm a burden. I want to die. Now, what if I had said, you know, Ernie, that's your choice. Let me find you some pills for you to kill yourself if that's what you want to do. That would have been a terrible abdication, but that's what these assisted suicide advocates say we should be doing. Instead, not only did I, in a very small way, but his family rallied around him and said, Ernie, we love you. We love you. We don't want you to die. His friends would come over. The man was covered with love, and you know what? He got better. He left hospice not because he died. He left hospice because he was no longer eligible for hospice because he improved and he got better.
One of the points you make is that an awful lot of people who are seen as candidates for euthanasia are clinically depressed. Leaving aside, quote, terminal cases, unquote, who are often misdiagnosed, a lot of them are simply depressed, and the American medical community, at least, is not well-versed in treating depression.
As the American medical community quickly admits.
Right. I mean, by the way, as we engage in this discussion, this should not be interpreted as casting aspersions on physicians, because as you point out in Chapter 6 about the HMOs, they themselves are under a great deal of pressure and have often, in individual cases, presented points of significant resistance to this movement.
Well, the physicians of this country are trying desperately to maintain their professionalism. You've got doctors, if you can imagine, trying to form unions so they have some kind of power against HMO executives who want them to cut the level of care. You've got for-profit HMOs that are forcing doctors to cut face time with patients to 12 minutes per visit. You've got doctors who are 25 or 30% or more of their compensation depends on cutting costs. Now, how does that impact assisted suicide and euthanasia? If assisted suicide and euthanasia ever comes to be seen as a, quote, legitimate medical treatment, close quote, what could be more cost-containing or cheaper for the HMO and therefore more profitable for the HMO than killing? If you could kill a cancer patient who has 8 months to live or so, rather than see them through that 8-month journey into a natural death, you'll make a ton of money as an HMO. What about a person with multiple sclerosis or ALS or any other chronic condition or debilitating profound disability? The money that can be made by HMOs, if we decide that the answer to difficulty or disability is killing, is awesome. And to say that we would not react to that is to be naive in the extreme. Too often, our values follow our pocketbooks. That's undeniable. You take a look at the horrible crime of human slavery that occurred in the United States. That occurred for one reason, and the racism that was created to justify it occurred because it made the leadership of the South a hell of a lot of money, and it made a lot of the merchants in the North who sold to the aristocracy of the South a lot of money, and that's why it was justified, and that's why it was so difficult to root out. And if you want a more modern version of values following pocketbook, just look at the tobacco industry. To say that we would not permit a change of our basic values that have governed us for 2,000 years that says killing is wrong, even when killing is desired because someone is sick, perhaps because they're receiving inadequate medical care, or because they're depressed, is to be naive. Once it makes people money, there'll be a reason to justify or rationalize doing it. And the rationalization will either be A, choice, or B, feudal care theory. Because these are lives not worth living, and for the compassion of the patient, as well as for the good of society, not to mention the pocketbook of the pressured doctor or the stock portfolio of the HMO investor, this person is better off dead. And if you don't think it's going to happen, if you don't think people would not only be killed voluntarily but involuntarily, just go to the Netherlands and see that thousands of people are killed each year by doctors who've never asked for it, and that's not based on any financial incentives.
Wesley, let me interrupt ever so briefly. A listener sent me something from the Electronic Telegraph. That's the Internet version of the Daily Telegraph in London. And this is from October 18th of 1998, an article by Rachel Bridge. Dutch carry cards that say, "Don't kill me, doctor," the first sentence. More than 10,000 people in Holland have started carrying anti-euthanasia, quote, passports, unquote, because they are frightened of being killed prematurely by over-enthusiastic doctors if they fall ill. And as you point out in Forced Exit, those fears are anything but unwarranted.
That's right. And in fact, now in the Netherlands, this wonderful rational society, doctors are killing infants born with birth defects at the request of parents, right out of permission to destroy life unworthy of life, right out of the Baby Knauer case in Germany, right out of Peter Singer's philosophy. So to say it won't happen is to be naive. It is happening in the Netherlands at the request of parents. It happened in Germany, and the Peter Singer, the greatest, I don't like to use the term great, but the foremost advocate of infanticide, has just been appointed, once again, I must repeat myself, to Princeton University in a very prestigious tenured bioethics chair. And I've just been told, I have not verified this, but I've been told that Princeton now is requiring every student to take at least one course in bioethics.
Oh, wow. That's a delightful prospect.
That's because bioethics is, in my view, I'm beginning to develop this thought process. I'm beginning to think it's not a process of viewing medical problems and difficulties, that it's an ideology.
Right.
And if you're forcing people to take a course in it, then it seems to me it's becoming an ideology.
Wesley, we're going to continue this discussion in the next half hour of this interview. I've been speaking with Wesley J. Smith, the co-author of four different titles with consumer advocate Ralph Nader, and the author of the consummately important title Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published in hardcover by Times Books, copyright 1997. Wesley, we're going to continue this discussion in the next half hour. For Wesley Smith, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.